This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. This episode, the President and CEO of AeroTech explains the process for engineering, testing, and certifying aircraft. In the news, we look at when Boeing expects deliveries of the 737 MAX to resume, the FAA's new ADS-B privacy policy, WOW rises from the ashes as Icelandic LCC play, and a gender reveal stunt that ends in a crash. Also, the commemorative Air Force's first Air Force One, the Evolution Turbine, comments on Garmin's Autoland, and the Sukhoi Superjet 100. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 578 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first David Vanderhoof, our aviation historian and military aviation expert. Hi, David.
Hello, everyone. As we're recording this, it's the 11th day of the 11th month. So happy Remembrance Day or Veterans Day to all of those who have served their nations and countries. So looking forward to a good show tonight.
That's right. Also with us is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk podcast, a CFI of the year, and he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft. Hi, Max.
Hey, Max. It's an all podcasting kind of day. Just finished up recording an episode for Aviation News Talk. So now we're here doing this. So just a great, great day hanging out, talking with people.
Wow. Did you have any time to go flying?
You know, I did get the one lesson in this morning. It was a ground lesson, though, but that's kind of nice occasionally as well, too. Otherwise, if it's all flying, it's all the same. And ground lessons are important, too.
Very good. Well, our guest this episode is Lee Heumann. He's president and CEO of AeroTech. That's AeroTech. The Aero in AeroTech stands for aerospace. The T is testing, the E is engineering, and the C is certification. AeroTech is an independent provider of initial engineering, design, and prototype manufacturing, as well as testing and airworthiness certification. The company uses in-house instrumentation, software, tools, and processes throughout the projects. Now, Lee has been personally involved in the testing, engineering, and certification of over 50 major aerospace projects, including aviation partners' blended winglets on the Boeing 737, 57, and 67, as well as Gulfstream, Hawker, and Falcon aircraft. Lee also worked on the Lockheed Martin Cooperative Avionics Testbed. That was a 737-300 with F-35 or JSF systems. Also, the Hawker Beechcraft King Air 250 and the Mitsubishi MRJ type certificate. Prior to starting AeroTech in 2003, Lee was flight test manager at Aviation Partners Boeing. And before that, he was a lead engineer at Aircraft Engineering Specialists. Lee's a graduate of the University of Massachusetts Amherst College of Engineering and has earned credentials as an FAA DER, as well as private multi-engine instrument pilot's license. Lee, welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Max. Good evening, everyone.
Great to have you. We're going to jump into the news in just a second, but first let me say that AeroTech is involved in so many interesting programs. We mentioned the winglets, but the company was involved in the Rolls-Royce flying testbed. There are supersonic aircraft activities taking place, and I think maybe the company has some action in the unmanned sector. Lee, for those who are not so familiar with AeroTech, how do you encapsulate what the company is all about?
Sure. We're a pretty interesting group. The team that we have and the capabilities we have is uncommon to find outside of what I would call an OEM, an aircraft manufacturing company like Boeing or Airbus or Lockheed. When you look at a large company, you can find all of the pieces of what we have within those teams, whether it's aeronautical engineering capability, manufacturing capability, aircraft modification capability, and the flight operations piece, the aircraft flight test piece, the instrumentation pieces. AeroTech is unique in the sense that we have a smaller scale of all of those aspects of aircraft development, and we can support anybody's program, whether it's such as the winglet programs that we did for Aviation Partners, could be a new and improved brake technology from a company that manufactures aircraft carbon brakes. It could be a special missions airplane that's a highly modified platform to perform one specific mission, like what we call the CAT-B or the Rolls-Royce flying test beds.
It's fascinating stuff. It sounds like never a dull day at the office with such a variety of projects. That's really wonderful. We're going to dive into some of those. Certainly want to talk about certification and the other activities that the company's involved in.
Yeah.
First, let's get started with some of the aviation news from the past week. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
First item comes from CNBC. This is Boeing expects to resume 737 MAX deliveries in December and commercial service green light in January. Well, actually, today, as we record this, Boeing said that the 737 MAX deliveries should resume in early December and that airlines could start flying the plane in January. Well, early December is only a few weeks away, and January will come up fast. Also, a few days ago, Southwest Airlines and American Airlines pulled the 737 MAX from their schedules until early March. So I don't know if there's a disconnect there or what. I mean, you would think that Boeing and, well, the FAA, the regulators, and the airlines would be having a lot of pretty close conversations about the status and when things are expected to happen. So I think it's kind of strange to me anyway that Southwest and American announced that just a few days ago. But I don't know. What do you guys think? Is this a cause for optimism, do you think?
I think it's a cause of, I don't want to be first, you be first. I don't want to be first, you be first.
There are a number of steps here. And of course, what Boeing is saying is that deliveries should resume in early December. So there's a lot of other things that have to happen. Most notably, I think, is training. And Boeing is saying that training for the pilots could take place in January. And so they're not really saying, I guess, that this will all happen. In other words, that the flights will resume in January, just that they think that all the pieces will be in place.
Kind of makes sense to me that they would like to start moving things through the pipeline early, if for no other reason that the parking lot's probably overflowing with aircraft at this point in time. But seriously, just getting these aircraft integrated back into an airline's operation is going to take some time. So I'm sure they would like to have those planes back in their possession for 6 weeks or so before they have to actually have them out there flying the line.
Yeah, that's a good point. With all the parked aircraft, clearly Boeing can't just throw a switch and deliver them all instantly. There's a process that they have to go through, not the least of which is, I would imagine, the implementation of any changes, any improvements to those aircraft. So they have to do that. I don't know if they've been doing that in parallel, in anticipation of getting the green light or not, or if it's something that will start once they get the green light. But a Boeing spokesman said, we know they need more time to get their fleets ready, that being the airlines, and pilots trained, but the plane and training approvals will both be done by January, permitting commercial service. Interestingly enough, Boeing shares went up 4% today on this news. But the FAA also had a comment. They reiterated that they have, quote, set no time frame for when the work will be completed. So we don't have anything from the FAA on this yet.
And we also, the airlines have to accept these aircraft. There's going to be a sort of a juggling pieces and who's accepting the first aircraft? Do they go in delivery order? Have some of those delivery orders been canceled? There's a logistics nightmare to this that I don't think anyone's really talking about.
Lee, is the certification or recertification process significant here? Or is it technically a recertification, do you think?
Yes. I mean, the FAA has clearly gone, and the EASA and other regulatory agencies are asking for a very thorough review of the changes that are being made to the airplane to address the issues. But I think what we've all seen in the news that they're going and digging deeper, right? Over the past few weeks, we've seen news reports around additional compliance data, and they've been going back to Collins, to, you know, the manufacturer of some of the flight control computers, and Rosemount, the manufacturer of the angle of attack probes. So it has to be, there's only one answer, and that is to evaluate every link in the chain and ensure that it's ready to reenter commercial service, ready to be recertified. And that's what they're doing right now. Just to comment on the logistics piece, I spent quite a bit of time out in Moses Lake, and last time I was out there, there was, I think it was just over 175 airplanes. It's pretty colorful out there in Moses Lake with all the different tails. And then there's another couple hundred airplanes down in San Antonio and elsewhere. And I think last count, there were approaching 700 airplanes that are impacted by this and still producing 40 something airplanes a month. So every month there's better part of another 50 airplanes. So the logistics of getting all of these airplanes where they need to go in the right configuration should not be underestimated. A lot of the airplanes are going to simply go directly to an airline. Obviously, there's a lot of Southwest Airlines airplanes that were in service that are parked, that simply are just going to go back into that service. And they will need the modifications, you know, to make them airworthy again. And that'll do that. And that'll be pretty straightforward. But what's not easy is many of the airplanes were subject to leasing arrangements. Right? Mm-hmm. Half of the world's airplanes are owned by leasing companies. Half of the world's airplanes are owned by airlines. So a lot of those leasing arrangements have changed. If we look at, and it's also, if we look at the news, there's a lot of airlines that are going out of business. It seems like every week we have a new name in the headlines that's either struggling or going out, whether it's Jet Airways, Thomas Cook, some of these other, you know, carriers. And so what does that mean? That means that a percentage of these airplanes were earmarked to go to customer A, Jet Airways, say. In the past year, the landscape is very different. That customer's not there anymore. You're absolutely right. There needs to now be, okay, what's going to happen with this particular serial number? It needs to get repainted. It needs to, maybe the configuration of the interior is wrong. Maybe the language on the placards is wrong. It was originally supposed to go to India, and now it's going to go to China. So how are we going to fix all those things?
There's the post-World War II solution where you fly them out of the factory right to the boneyard.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen here. Yeah. But yeah, I would imagine there are just a lot of tires that need to be pumped up and a lot of struts that need to be, you know, checked to see if they're inflated properly. And just think about the maintenance issues associated with an aircraft sitting on the ground for 6 or 9 months. Holy cow. That is a whole lot of checks to be made on, what, upwards of 700 aircraft. And then just the logistics of flying, finding the pilots to move all those airplanes from where they're being stored now to where they need to be. Of course, they have to start this soon. If they waited till they're supposed to be in service, there just wouldn't be enough manpower to make all this stuff happen.
And how many of those aircraft have yet to fly?
Oh, a lot of them. Yeah, quite a lot of them. Yeah, if this takes, I don't know, 6 months to clear out this backlog, I wouldn't be surprised.
But we do know it's going to be the safest airplane out there. I'm thinking it's the only airplane I'll ever fly again, because they will have, you know, verified that this thing is safe, you know, far more than they've done with any other aircraft ever.
For sure. All right. Well, let's move on to our next story. This is from Aviation Today. What FAA's new ADS-B privacy policy means for business aviation operators. So a new privacy ICAO address, a PIA, is to be available starting January 1st, 2020. And this is on the 1090 megahertz ADS-B out frequency in U.S. domestic airspace. And this is to address the concern of, well, especially business aviation and general aviation to a certain extent, that there needs to remain a means by which to remain anonymous on a flight for business reasons, for competitive reasons. And so this is going to happen in two phases. First, business and GA operators will be able to apply for the program directly through the FAA. But later, the FAA intends to transition this service to a third-party service provider. So, Max T., are you familiar with what this policy change is all about here?
I think I know a little bit about this. If you look back to the days of before ADS-B, many business aircraft chose to have their call sign blocked so that the aircraft couldn't be tracked through various services like FlightAware and things like that. And with ADS-B, that has provided a new way for people to kind of monitor the movements of aircraft because, in addition to having the FAA ground stations, which would, you know, pick up ADS-B transmissions from these aircraft, there are also some private networks, again, most notably FlightAware.com, which has probably more than 1,000 receivers scattered around the world. So even if the FAA were to block the call signs after they were received by FAA equipment, these other privately owned systems would still be seeing the call signs of these aircraft. So it looks like the FAA is come up with a new program that says, well, instead of putting your call sign into your ADS-B out device, we'll give you a pseudonym, you know, some random combination of, you know, letters and numbers that you can put in. And that's what people will see when they see your ADS-B output. And we, the FAA, probably will have some type of translation program so that, you know, we can see who you are, but the, you know, the private operators out there won't be able to track the aircraft. And, you know, why do people do this? You can just imagine that if, you know, a large Fortune 500 company has a jet that's suddenly shows up at the airport of their major competitor, people might start to go, whoa, looks like a merger and acquisition in process. And people don't want that kind of information to get out. So that's why blocking of aircraft numbers has been popular with business owners in the past.
I got the sense that this is something that where you would get a or could get a different call sign for each flight plan that you file. Is that the sense you get?
I don't know that it's for every flight plan. I think what it's going to be is the identifier that's in the ADS-B out equipment. So right now, when Avionics Shop installs the equipment, they are supposed to put in the N number for that aircraft. Now, they don't always do it correctly 100% of the time. I have seen some aircraft flying around with numbers that clearly aren't their N numbers. It's pretty rare, but it looks to me like they're just going to replace that N number.
That seems like an easy one to crack. I mean, there's so many plane spotters out there with a little handheld receiver. You could quickly, on the open net, you know, come up with a new decoder table.
You know, that's a real good point. You could, you know, airplane spotters could collect data and say, hey, look what looks like Apple's airplane just landed at San Jose. And hey, look, this code for that airplane is here. So that code must equal that airplane. So yeah, that does raise an interesting question about whether they change it every flight. I would have thought that it's just, you know, per aircraft.
When I see a November number on an airplane at the airport, and I go look at it on Flight Tracker and it's not there, but there's some other number that just magically appeared. Ooh, 1 + 1 = 3. That must be the same aircraft.
Yeah, that's one reason why I think that this kind of works like Apple Pay, right? With Apple Pay, you get a new token, or in this case, a new call sign, for each transaction, or in this case, for each flight plan. So I think you'd have the ability to enter that number that could change with each flight plan. But,
and you know what? As I look at this in more detail, you may be right on that. I hadn't realized that they were getting down to that level of detail, but that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the FAA says that the NBAA and members of the GA community, they say, have cited the lack of privacy as a barrier to ADS-B out equipage, right? This is the mandate, and the FAA is suggesting here that some people have been holding off on being so equipped because they would not be able to be anonymous. But the FAA says in order to mitigate these concerns, the FAA has initiated the Privacy ICAO Address Program with the objective of improving the privacy of aircraft operators in today's ADS-B environment by limiting the extent to which the aircraft can be quickly and easily identified by non-U.S. government entities while ensuring there's no adverse effect on ATC services. So, and I think the NBAA was, I think the article states that they were a driving force behind developing this approach. All right, on to WOW. Remember WOW Airlines? Well, we have a couple of articles. There's one in Simple Flying, bankrupt WOW to relaunch as Play. Play is the new, is a new low-cost carrier. They're going to fly the A320 family, both passengers and freight, like WOW East and West to Iceland, except they're going to start by focusing on serving Europe. They expect to grow the fleet to 6 aircraft serving Europe, and then they're going to look at North American routes maybe by the summertime. But bright red livery with a big white Play logo. They have a website up, sort of. It's flyplay.com.
Yeah, I guess the big question is going to be, what are they going to do different that's going to make this more economically viable than WOW was? You know, so far, I don't see much that sounds different. But I hope they're successful. I flew WOW once, and it was a good experience. And we could certainly use low-cost carriers going across the Atlantic, but there does seem to be, you know, an issue with those companies. You look at Norwegian. Norwegian has been struggling. You know, it's just, I think, open to question whether the long distance discount model really works.
You may recall that I think we talked a few months ago about Michelle Ballerin had a press conference and announced that her company, U.S. Aerospace Associates, would purchase WOW Air's assets. And their intent at the time was to resurrect the airline. Now, they said that they would begin operations in October, but that's been delayed a bit. Now, December is what they're talking about. And they say that they'll focus on cargo transport first before operating passenger flights. But they have a big employment effort. They need a lot of the staff, the positions, they need flight crews, they need pilots, as well as the, you know, back office kinds of things. But I think it's by no means a done deal from the standpoint of financing. There's an article in Iceland Monitor where they note that the airline is looking for Icelandic investors for 12 million euros, which would be a 50% share in Play. The founders would own the other 50%. And if they can get that funding, then there's a British investment fund, Athleen Capital. Then they would kick in an additional 40 million euros as a loan, along with the option to buy a 10% stake, if they wanted to. But Play is already starting to create the buzz, I guess, about the possibilities. If you visit their webpage or their Facebook page, which is Play Airline, you'll learn that they're starting a sale this month in November, and they're going to give away 1,000 free tickets if you sign up with your email address. So I guess if you'd like to partake in that, what's the risk, I guess, right?
Well, I did sign up, and so far I haven't won, and I haven't heard back from them. When you do sign up, you have to tell them what airport you're looking to fly out of. And it was tough because they listed San Francisco, and I thought, I'm not sure that's going to be one of the first destinations they will add. So I said, sign me up for Boston. That's where I flew out of last time with WOW.
Yeah, I should sign up. I'll put in Boston as well. All right, one more story, and this is from AvWeb. Gender reveal stunt injures pilot, damages plane. Now, I'll be honest with you. When I saw this term gender reveal, I really wasn't sure what that meant. And I think it turns out it means something a lot more benign than I had in my head.
It's the current trend for people who are pregnant to have a party and a special way to reveal to everyone the sex of the child that hasn't arrived yet.
So in this case,
you either do pink or blue.
Right. And so the expectant mother is expecting a daughter, a girl. And so pink was the color. And Max Truscott, how did they display the pink?
Well, rather interesting idea. I must have been somebody who had something to do with aviation who is pregnant, because I don't think, you know, somebody off the street would come up with this idea. But apparently they found an agricultural aircraft, an air tractor, which is normally used for crop dusting, and they arranged to have it loaded with 350 gallons of pink water so that the aircraft could announce the news to family and friends who were apparently gathered somewhere for this. Ironically, this stunt occurred near Turkey. No, not in the Middle East, but near Turkey, Texas, which I'd never heard of Turkey, Texas. But
anyway. Foul on that joke.
Yeah. So fortunately, the pilot did not die in this, so I guess we can joke about this. But anyway, this is a very capable turboprop aircraft, single pilot, used for crop dusting. And when they did their water dump, there's a picture here showing the pink water coming out of the back of the airplane. Apparently, the pilot got too slow and he stalled the airplane and he crashed. The pilot suffered minor injuries and nobody on the ground was hurt. I've seen another picture of the airplane and boy, I don't think that airplane is going to fly again. It's pretty well banged up. So who knows what happens, but you know, when people do different kinds of flying that they're not used to, in this case, this guy's used to flying close to the ground, but not dumping a load of water all at one time. You know, something went wrong. So it's important to, you know, fly the same way every time. In this particular case, something the pilot did was not correct. He got too slow and crashed.
Hmm. And this is a trend of these gender revealed parties going badly wrong, like fireworks going off improperly. And, you know, we could go back to the simple things in life. You know, it's a boy or it's a girl, hand out some cigars. it seems to be a lot safer.
Yeah. You know how it is these days. Anything to get that video that's going to go viral. As I commented when I was visiting the Grand Canyon a couple weeks ago, I saw some videos that could definitely have gone viral had people taken one more step backwards. So you got to be really, really careful when you're doing these kinds of stunts.
Again, we're speaking with Lee Heumann, President and CEO of AeroTech. Thanks again for coming on the show. Let's talk a little bit about the certification process, because that's obviously been in the news a lot with the 737 MAX certification process. Where does that take place over the course of the entire development process, let's say? Is it something that happens at the end, or is it something that sort of incrementally occurs throughout the design and development process? What can you tell us?
Sure. I think the easiest way to explain it is to take a backwards look, because there is a big event at the end, which is very recognizable. And ultimately, a certification of either a new airplane or even a modified airplane results in what the FAA calls a type certificate or a supplemental type certificate. And that certificate is what everyone needs to legally sell that product. It is the FAA's authorization that, yes, that design meets all of the regulatory criteria and you are good to go to sell that product to whoever wants it. But that one piece of paper, which is all it is, by the way, is the culmination of years, if not a decade's worth of work to check that every single federal aviation regulation, that every single component on that airplane is in compliance with the rules. That is an effort that really needs to be planned and contemplated from day one. And this is something that we help our customers with when they're developing new airplanes or an aircraft mod, is to say, okay, first of all, before we even get into the details on the design, what do we need to have in place to be certified? And which regulations are going to be impacted? What are the rules? And that really sets the requirements for the program. You know, there are customer requirements, right? There's maintainability requirements. And then ultimately, there are what we call certification requirements, which are black and white. They have to be met. And once you've shown all that, you get your type certificate or TC, as we call it. One thing that needs to be recognized is that, you know, the FAA is the authority, but they don't have enough people. There are not enough people in the entire, if you took the FAA and the European EASA and put them all together, there's still not enough engineering resources to look at every aspect of every airplane. It's impractical. And so that's why there's a partnership between Boeing and Airbus and companies like Aerotech with the FAA to provide an organizational delegation and to provide special highly qualified engineers that can act on behalf of the FAA to do a first pass look at the design, whether it's could be just a valve, you know, a fuel valve, it could be an avionics box, it could be airplane structure. And in each, there's specialists that know they're experts in particular areas. And we call them either in the Boeing sense, they would call them unit members. And the outside, a company like Aerotech, we call them DERs, designated engineering representatives. And there's a whole system of people and processes and procedures to do this work. And it takes years. And every single drawing, every single part of that airplane has been looked at from a certification perspective by at least one and likely three or five different specialist DERs or unit members.
Now, Lee, in my experience, the DERs that I've met and worked with, I would say that all of them are more dedicated to their profession, let's say, than they are to the company, which is the way I think we want it. Do you find that to be the case broadly? Is that a concern that there's maybe pressure from the manufacturer or the employer of the DER to make decisions or to make assumptions that, you know, are from one standpoint or one point of view that's different than what the DER would do on his own or her own?
Yeah, you bet. I think. This is an easy one to answer. I think the FAA has done a very, very good job. It recognized that I used to be a DER. I've since hung up my ticket because I'm too busy running Aerotech. The FAA does a very good job of helping all of us in the compliance review community know what our roles are and what our job is in that capacity, and that we're not to be pressured by the applicant, as we would say, whether it's, you know, the people that are making the product. I know many, many DERs, and we all have the same culture and mission that we've signed up for, and that is safety first, compliance, do the right thing, and the product has to stand up to the requirements. I'm sure people that are not in the business would, you know, might extrapolate a little bit and say, oh, well, surely there's pressures, schedule pressures, and other, you know, job threatening pressures. I think if you talk to other DERs, they recognize their value and what they do. And if one applicant is being difficult and doesn't want to do the job right, they can go get a job somewhere else. You know, they can pick up that other work. So I believe in the system that the FAA set up.
So do we think there was a breakdown in that system at Boeing with the, well, not just with the 737 MAX, but, you know, we get with the whole, with the tanker and the issues that aircraft has gone under? It doesn't feel like it's an issue with the specific individuals who are, you know, making these decisions and signing off on these things. But is there a larger issue, do you think, that needs to be dealt with? Or is the, you know, congressional outcry and public outcry kind of not warranted, do you think?
Boy, this is a tough one to wade into.
I know.
you know, I'll give my opinion. I think that a situation like the MAX And you know, airplane accidents are tragic, and these things don't happen because of one issue, right? These are this is an error chain that has multiple links long. And to get to where we've had to where we are today with the MAX, there have been multiple errors in different places, whether it's in the Boeing company, in the FAA, elsewhere. It's very hard to put your finger on one root cause, for at least from my perspective. Which this is a difficult part, technically, from the certification standpoint, I believe the people did what they were asked to do. I think the engineers at Boeing were given guidance around what the certification criteria was, and they did their job to that criteria. Hindsight being 2020, I think we would challenge the certification criteria, meaning specifically single channel systems, dual channel systems, cross communication between different flight control computers, cockpit alerting. You know, these are all very complex conversations. The reality is the Boeing 737 is, and the MAX is a derivative. It's the airplane has been built. This is the 10th version. You know, the 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, 600, 700, 800, 900-10. There's a lot, you know, maybe that's it. Maybe it's too much of that. Maybe there's too much legacy, and what was designed in 1965 needs to have a refresh, a relook. So it's unfair to point at any one link in the chain and declare absolute fault. It's unfortunate. I think there's a lot of lessons learned, both in industry, but also in regulatory and government, and even at the operator level and the airline level.
Yeah, it's a complex problem. And it's unfortunate that, you know, we have to deal with it. When I say we, I mean Congress and regulators and the industry as a whole. It's unfortunate that we have to deal with it sort of in the context of loss of life, which adds a different dimension. Well, let's talk a little bit more specifically about aerotech. Now, we talk about the testing, engineering, and certification functions at aerotech. How are those interrelated?
Yeah. Hindsight being 2020, it wouldn't have been aerotech. It would have been aero ETC, probably, because of the firing order of the events. Yeah. You know, the engineering comes first, right? You've got, you're designing, starting with the requirements again, and going through the preliminary design process, the critical design process, getting into all of, you know, the defining what the product is. And again, it could be a brand new airplane. It could be a conversion from a passenger to a freighter. The process is the same. And then comes the testing, and it starts with component level testing in laboratories where we'll take every piece of the airplane and subject it to extreme temperature and vibration and electromagnetic interference and other things. And then we start to build subsystems and do rig testing as a subsystem. And then eventually it gets to the entire airplane. And there's typically years of testing before the airplane is complete and fully evaluated for all the certification requirements.
And why do your customers come to you? Is that because to have all that capability internally, the utilization would be kind of low because large programs are not constantly taking place? You know, there may be some time between them. Is that the reason why, or are there other reasons?
There's a couple reasons. I'll start. So the first one you're hinting at is, you know, for a large OEM like Boeing or Airbus or even business jet manufacturers, Gulfstream, Textron, yeah, they have a core team, but often they might have multiple programs going on. And a good example is we helped Boeing recently with a cargo conversion certification for the 737-800. They're totally capable of doing it themselves, but they had many other programs going on, and it was a nice piece of work that they were able to contract to aerotech, and we still worked very closely with many of their team members. but we were able to do all the heavy lifting for the flight test and some of the certification support. So that's kind of one category. I'll call it offload for convenience. And again, either it's a smaller program, they don't want to deal with it, or they need some supplemental support on a major program. You know, the truth is large OEMs, and whether it's transport category, commercial or business jets, their role is to sell airplanes, to build and sell airplanes. And some of these other minor modification activities, frankly, are a distraction, and we can help them do those smaller pieces. The other element to this is, I'll put it in the newcomer category, where a company wants to develop an airplane, but might be lacking some of the experience or the organization to do some of the key pieces. And, you know, to help them through that same engineering testing certification process, we're doing some very exciting things right now in the electric aircraft space. We have two amazing customers. One is a new manufacturer for electric aircraft power systems. The engine, I can't really call it an engine or a motor. It's really a propulsion system, I guess is the right way to say it. And that's Magni X in Redmond here in Washington State.
Oh, yes, we've talked about them. Yes.
Yeah, cool company. Hmm. And another newcomer, Eviation, that's out of Israel, and they're making a clean sheet all-electric airplane that's similar in class to King Air. And it's great. These kinds of programs are really moving technology forward. They're often new companies with great ideas, and they just need the support in the areas that they don't have, and they may need help building an organization that they don't yet have. And that's one of our things that we're happy to do, is help these customers get on their feet, build an organization, help them with organizational strategy and program planning, and then eventually work ourselves out of a job.
Mm-hmm. For something like electric aircraft, because that is developing so quickly, do you have to bring on additional talent in order to support a customer like that? Or are you able to, you know, handle it with the resources that you have in-house already?
Yeah, I think it depends. Many times we can handle it with the resources we have. But the truth is, some of these programs, they start off, you can imagine, you know, a customer will walk in and say, hey, I just need a little help with this, and this. And that's great. And then suddenly that says, well, you did a great job there. Now we need help with this other system or this other piece. And it's great because the business grows. And then we do need to add people. You know, we do find additional talent. I think that a couple things around the talent. First of all, this is why we're in the Pacific Northwest. There's great talent here, although we do attract talent from all over the U.S. and all over the world, Canada and Australia and Brazil. But there's, I think for the most part, there has not yet been a technology so new that it has not been, it does not fit within the standard aircraft development certification process, if that makes sense, we're able to apply our skills to even some of these eVTOL new systems. As crazy as they might look, there's nothing specifically new about that, about these systems. They're just maybe reconfigured in a different way.
Generally, where do you find your employees? I mean, do you look for folks who've been in the industry for a while and have some experience, or do you also hire, you know, fresh kids out of college?
For us, the perfect ratio is one-third, two-thirds. It's one-third subject matter experts, you know, which are the people that, you know, have been in industry, know the business very well. Again, the process is the same, no matter which OEM you work for. And then the other two-thirds are, you know, the brilliant young people coming out of university or are younger in their career. And for us, that balance is fun. We don't take ourselves too seriously at Aerotech. We like to work hard, play hard, and you know, having good mentors in with the subject matter experts, being able to work with a, you know, kind of a two-for-one ratio there, works out really, really well.
What caused you to want to create this company? Did you created this out of nothing, right? There was no predecessor to Aerotech when you started this.
That's right. I've never had a real job. I think it came about out of a necessity. You mentioned when you introduced me, I worked with a company, Aviation Partners, and before that, a small company, Aircraft Engineering Specialists. I've had a lot of fortune throughout my career, and I had an amazing mentor for the first 10 years working at a very small company. His name's Larry Timmons. And being a small company, and he was the SME and I was the young college grad, and he was my mentor and threw me into whatever. And I got to see all aspects of this job from engineering, doing the engineering work, working with the FAA, flying on test flights, writing the reports. And then I was flight test manager for Aviation Partners for not very long. And the way Aerotech came about was APB is a great, great company that made some amazing products for airlines, which have saved billions and billions of gallons of jet fuel. But the product development lifecycle for them was pretty long, every couple of years or even 3 years from the time we went from, 757 to 767, et cetera. And for me, the writing was on the wall. It was good to have a department, but we weren't going to survive because there was going to be too much of a gap between one program and the next for a small company like Aviation Partners to afford a flight test certification group. So I put together a business plan and I pitched it to the board of directors and I said, hey, let me take the good team that we have here and let me go start a company and we'll contract back. And oh, by the way, we'll go find other work, which will keep us busy. And that's exactly what happened. And so that was back in 2003. And we've gone from a 4-person organization to over 200.
Oh, that's amazing.
So you basically outsourced yourself then?
Yes. Yes, I fired myself.
and it worked out. That's great.
That's good.
Yeah.
Were there any particular challenges with the winglets in terms of getting them certified? Any issues that came up or anything?
Oh, yeah. People, so don't underestimate the complexity of just the little, what looks like an innocent little wingtip
right,
change,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So that little device, it impacts the aerodynamics. It impacts the structure. It impacts lighting, wingtip lights, the ice protection systems, and the list goes on and on. So, boy, lots of stories, too many for this podcast. But anytime you modify a complex machine, whether a business jet, transport category airplane, large transport, unexpected things occur. Here's how silly it can be. We put winglets on one airplane and the strobe light, we had to move the strobe light at the anti-collision light that was on the wingtip. And the location that it ended up going to, it was flashing in just a way that it was reflecting off of the shiny leading edge and flashing into the cockpit.
And you can't anticipate something like that.
We were done, right? That was the last thing, was just to go check out the lights. And we ended up having to go on to a recertification effort around lighting and move the light and redo things. That's just one little story, but this is why it's expensive to do this kind of work. There's always something.
So that's a good example of the law of unintended consequences.
Yes. But that's what makes that's why testers have a job. If engineering was perfect, you'd make your drawing, you'd make your part, everything would be great. That much we know never happens. And as testers, the very first thing that we know is that we're going to find something. And the minute someone says, oh, don't worry about it, that's when we start to perk up.
Yeah, it almost sounds like it's each project is a discovery, is an adventure, let's say, where you don't know what you're going to discover. And when you do discover it, you have to figure out how you're going to address it.
Yeah, and a lot of these lessons, sometimes we have to relearn, unfortunately. I mean, we've done a lot of programs, our team, And sometimes we'll have a customer that we've seen this show before. We try to explain to them, it's like, look, these things are, here's your risks, and these are the issues that we're worried about on this product. And, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but sometimes they've got to relearn some of those lessons before they're like, oh, okay, now we understand what you're talking about. We're going to pay more attention, if that makes sense.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about the Supersonic Flight Alliance?
Yeah, this is an exciting space. I gave a talk on this recently at the Aerospace Futures Alliance. I have a photograph that we found of the Concorde. It's taken a long time ago, black and white photograph, actually in Moses Lake, Washington. And Moses Lake is not a destination hotspot on people's vacation list. I love it because it's agricultural and it's a great place for flight testing. It's where we have our flight test center. And the reason I share that is because, you know, there has been a little bit of supersonic flight test history here in Washington State. But since then, you know, the only supersonic activity we ever see is military jets on a rare occasion that something gets scrambled and off they go. You know, we know now that there is a market for supersonic travel, whether it's business jets, but also there's a market for commercial supersonic travel. The equation for, you know, the physics hasn't changed, but the technology certainly has. And, you know, what used to be, admittedly, you know, you look at the 60s, 70s, even 80s technology, supersonic airplanes, and they're just obnoxious. I mean, they're environmentally insensitive from all aspects, whether it's noise or pollution, fill in the blank. And that's what a lot of people think of when they think of supersonic airplanes. That doesn't have to be the case anymore. Technology has, both in the engine development, but also the, you know, new modern aerodynamics tools and modern aerostructures with composites, et cetera, you can address, and even modern fuels, you can address all of those things, including the emissions piece. There was a convention down in Las Vegas a couple weeks ago, the National Business Aviation Association convention.
Right.
And there were several large business jets that flew in on 100% biofuel, 100%. And there are activities, you know, for carbon offsets, et cetera. So there's an opportunity here, a real one, to have, I'll say, responsible supersonic travel. And there are now big players involved in this space that are sincerely designing and putting, you know, real airplanes forward. The big ones, obviously, Ariane out of Reno, Nevada, that's now partnering with Boeing as an investor. There's Boom Supersonic out of Denver that's looking at a supersonic airliner, not looking at, designing supersonic airliner. And they're going to fly their supersonic demonstrator here very soon. Very soon, meaning in the next year, and others. You know, we think that there's other business jet manufacturers looking at supersonics. So, the Flight Alliance, where does that fit in? What we are trying to do is provide a space for responsible supersonic airplane development, and we're trying to do that here in Washington State by identifying a airspace, a corridor, which would allow supersonic flight test. And it would be conveniently placed just north of Moses Lake to allow safe test operations, and would attract all of these, you know, major development companies to bring their business to us for obviously the flight test piece of it and the certification piece, but also to help our local aerospace community up here to bring more OEMs to the Pacific Northwest.
We've said many times that, you know, these are not dull times in the aviation world all the things that are going on, electric and unmanned and supersonic and all. It must be pretty exciting to have, I mean, for you personally, to have, you know, your foot in some of these doors.
Oh, it's I don't have an alarm clock. I just jump out of bed first thing in the morning. You know, it is very exciting. I share your comment. I'm coming up on my 50th birthday here. I've been in this business for a little while. I haven't seen this much energy and innovation and also funding all at the same time in my career. And it's really fun. It's really, there's some great things happening. And it is very exciting to be able to contribute meaningfully, technically, to bringing these things to light.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Well, great. If people want to learn more about AeroTech, where should they go?
Well, first stop is our website, www.aerotec.com. No K, no H. It's unfortunate. Most people misspell it. And that gives an overview of our company and what we do and the technical services we offer and a little bit about our team.
All right. Very good. And as you were talking about the Supersonic Flight Alliance, I looked that up, and I find that at ssfa.aero, A-E-R-O.
That's right.
Folks want to learn some more about that. All right. Lee Heumann, thank you so much for coming on the show, talking to us and our audience about all the exciting things that AeroTech is doing. It's another example, I think, of a possible career path for people. A lot of folks kind of focus on becoming a pilot. And there are, as you well know, there are certainly many, many other possible career paths that are really immersed in aviation. AeroTech is a good example of that.
I just want to thank you, Max, and Max T and Dave. Really enjoyed talking with you guys. I always love talking about airplanes and this industry and where things are going. And thanks again.
No, thank you.
Yeah, I agree with your comment earlier about I don't think I've ever seen a more exciting time in design and aviation in my entire lifetime. It's incredible how everything is just on fire.
It is. It is.
What's up with the geeks? Max Trescott. I know this is going to be about you and another airplane, right?
Another airplane? Me? I have nothing to do with airplanes. Oh, wait, that's my life is airplanes. Yeah, exactly. On Aviation News Talk, some of the most popular episodes have been the ones where I've been ferrying an aircraft across the country. And I haven't had those for probably close to a year because after a spate of, 3-4 trips, it's just been a quiet year. But I have a couple coming up. So next week I'm headed out to Miami to bring a Cirrus SR-22 back to California. And then the next month, December, I've got one coming from Knoxville back to California. So we'll probably turn at least one of those or maybe both of those into episodes so people can kind of hear what the thought process is as we're dealing with weather and the many other issues that occur with being on a long flight like that. But I did just finish recording episode 129, which will be out this week on Aviation News Talk, and that's about instrument check ride preparation. So that's both for folks who are studying to become instrument pilots and a great review for people who already are instrument pilots. So I took a risk and I said, you know what? I'm going to have an examiner give me an on-the-air oral check ride. And I did it with no resources here, no open Google forums or things like that. And I think I passed. So it was a fun way to review everything you need to know about instrument flying.
Very good. Busy boy.
Always.
All right. Up next, we have a recording that our reporter at large, Launchpad Mirzari, sent in. It turns out that the Commemorative Air Force has, the first Air Force One. And Launchpad speaks with Nick Weidenkopf at Wings Over Dallas about this airplane. So let's listen to those two.
Hey, airplane geeks, this is your reporter at large, Launchpad Mirzari, and we're here at the Wings Over Dallas, and I've run into
Nick Weidenkopf.
And Nick, we're standing in front of this really pretty Strike Commander. Well, what's special about this Strike Commander?
Well, this is one of the ones that President Eisenhower actually flew, and he flew in it, but he also flew it.
Wow, and now the sign says this was the first Air Force One?
That's correct. There was actually a mix-up when he was flying on his Constellation, the Combine 2, and an Eastern Airlines flight. They both had the same last call signs, 6810. What happened was they didn't know which aircraft the president was on board. So the Secret Service got together with ATC and said, hey, look, let's from now on, we're going to make this Air Force One. So after that plane came down, he flew this one next. So this was the first airplane that actually had the call sign Air Force One when the president was on board.
And it's painted up in its original 1956, I assume, mm-hmm. paint scheme.
That's correct.
All right. Now, this isn't just a replica airplane. This is the airplane.
That's correct. The Air Force purchased a bunch of them, but two of them were only used to have Ike commute him back and forth to Gettysburg. You know, he had a farm in Gettysburg, and that was his weekend getaway. So what they did is they'd fly him from Washington to Gettysburg. It's about 70 miles. And this is a short field landing aircraft, so we can land on the short fields, not like the Super Constellation.
And today that mission is fulfilled by?
Now that one is fulfilled by Marine One. This is, you know, back in the 50s when Ike was the president, we didn't have a reliable helicopter that could do it. But now we have these Marine One aircraft that can do it.
All right, and this just isn't a museum piece. Oh, we got a little air show ambience going on. This isn't just a museum piece. People can buy rides in this airplane and be like Ike.
Absolutely. Of the 15 that the United States Air Force bought of these aero commanders, this is the only one that's still flying and still flight-worthy, and we're going to give rides to veterans beginning next year.
Now, that's a service that we're offering for free, right?
Absolutely. There are people that can go on our website and purchase a ride, and they can actually buy it for themselves. But for the veterans, we're trying to make it free. We have a way for you can donate on the website, too, so that other veterans can do it if you want to donate to some veteran.
And since you brought that up, what is that website where people could go to learn more?
It's Ikesburg, like Ike. I-K-E and Bird, BIRD.org.
And it's more than just taking a ride.
Absolutely. You can also actually sit in the aircraft when it's available and have your picture taken in it.
There you go, listeners. You can be presidential and buy a ride in Air Force One. This is your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
All right. Thanks, Launchpad. And that website, again, is ikesbird.org, ikesbird.org. You can see it over at the Commemorative Air Force website, commemorativeairforce.org, which I did because I wanted to see what this thing looked like because I wasn't very familiar with this aero commander. Lee, you fly twins or have flown twins. Ever fly anything like an aero commander? There were not too many of these things built.
I've never been in the piston version. There's a turbine version that I've been in, which is built a little bit later. It's a cool airplane.
Oh, yeah. And this is, you know, you think of Air Force One, of course, we think of, you know, large airliners, which this obviously wasn't. But if you visit the Commemorative Air Force page, they have a much, much larger fleet than I ever knew. I mean, they've got, I don't know what the total count is for aircraft, but gosh, if it's 50, I wouldn't be surprised.
You know, I was thinking the Aero Commander, depending on the version of it, you can seat probably 8 to 10 people, something like that. Imagine a president who was able to travel around with fewer than 8 or 10 people. I mean, these days, poor president probably doesn't move around with fewer than 20 or 30 people, you know, just moving, shadowing his every movement. But there was also a version of the Aero Commander, which was the one that Bob Hoover used to do for many of his air routines. And I think that one is now in the Smithsonian, as I recall.
It is. And what was interesting, the comment, though, that was sort of offhandedly touched was Eisenhower was actually flying the aircraft.
Yeah, I heard him say that.
Which is, the only other president that actually flew an aircraft happened to be George Bush when he landed aboard in Navy One. The S3 Viking. So he was actually at the controls of that. So
he landed on an aircraft carrier.
But he landed on an aircraft carrier.
Well, and Bush's father, of course, flew in World War II. So those are the other pilots that I can think of.
But Eisenhower was notorious for flying. There was a P-51 that they took out the back seat, and on June 7th, 1944, he flew a P-51B with two seats, and he was in the back seat, and he flew over the invasion, much to everyone's surprise, and he wanted to look down. And that aircraft eventually became known as the Stars Look Down, meaning the five-star general looked down on the coast.
Interesting. All right.
Very cool story, David.
Yeah. All right, on to some listener mail. We heard from Josh. He said, I've been listening to the podcast for a while. Just wanted to say it's a great companion to my commute. He says, I've just changed career. I'm now a lawyer, but previously worked in customs at Heathrow. And although the shifts were hard work, I did enjoy the occasional opportunity to go look aboard the aircraft. So Josh says, I'm listening to episode 577, and I wanted to correct something you said about the shadow cabinet. We mentioned that last time. They aren't the direct equivalent of an undersecretary, he says, as they don't actually have any role within government and no special access to the department. The role is much more aspirational in nature than practical. And then Josh wanted to join the Slack channel, so we'll look for Josh there. Someone else who wanted to join the Slack channel is our favorite 13-year-old listener, Zeke. And we just sent him an invite today. He had a couple of questions that he was asking. He left another voicemail. And I don't know if it's Zeke's end of things or the Google Voice voicemail capability, but it's been kind of hard to understand Zeke. But he was asking about the communication with the passenger and ATC on the Garmin Autoland that we talked about. And he raises a question like, well, what about if you only speak Spanish? Is the Autoland going to help you there? Max, I imagine this is just in English, at least at this point.
I suspect that they can provide a localization and change the languages. But yes, I would imagine that the first version is just English. But, you know, what I would point out is if you push the button, then of course, you know, it's going to make the landing anyway. But yeah, I think particularly for the communications, not just with a passenger, but for ATC as well, even though English is supposedly the universal language of ATC, boy, there's some countries where they really prefer their local language.
Lee, is the certification process for something like this Garmin Autoland avionics, I guess, is it conceptually the same as an aircraft component like a winglet? Is it same process basically?
This is different. I think, you know, if you compare, let's take the Boeing 767 has Autoland, right? And nearly all large commercial airplanes can land themselves. That certification is extremely complex because it's used on a daily basis. This feature, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Garmin because I think they are starting with the Garmin 430 moving map. They have saved so many lives in general aviation, and this is yet another step. But this is an emergency function.
Right.
And this is the pilot is incapacitated, and you know, previous to this, unfortunately, everyone was going to die because unless you knew how to fly the airplane and could get the pilot out of the way, it was going to be a very sad event. This is now literally magic, where your 11-year-old daughter can punch the red button, and there's going to be ambulances waiting for you at the airport when you get on the ground. This is amazing. So because it's truly an emergency feature, it's a different certification criteria. So it needs to be shown that it performs its intended function, which Garmin certainly has done, and that it's compatible with airspace and the autonomous communications are remarkable, and making sure that the FAA can accept what those communications are going to be during this event is all part of it. But fundamentally, it's a different certification requirement.
Okay, interesting. Good. Zeke also asked about, he'd heard about a recent plane crash in Russia or maybe Poland. He wasn't sure. Apparently, Zeke might be flying into that area. And, you know, when you look around for plane crashes in Russia, you don't have to look too far before you find some, it seems. Maybe that's not a fair statement, but there was a recent Sukhoi Superjet 100 operated by Yamal Airlines, and they had an engine failure shortly after takeoff. We'll have a link to an article from the Moscow Times that talks about this, but they dumped fuel and landed safely. I don't know what the reason for the engine failure was on that airplane, but the Sukhoi, the Superjet 100s have been exhibiting, well, a few issues. Previously, there was an Aeroflot-owned Superjet 100 that crash-landed at the Moscow airport, in which case 41 people were killed. Now, they did not dump fuel on that. There was a report of a lightning strike that maybe took out the comms, but I'm not positive on that. But it landed with full tanks, and so there was a fire, and we see the result of that, 41 killed. So if you're not familiar with the Superjet 100, it's a regional jet, sort of smallish. Engines are power jet engines, turbofans. They're made by, it's actually a joint venture between a Russian company, the NPO Saturn, and Safran from France. But they've been having some problems with that. But as I mentioned, Zeke asked if he could join the Slack team, so we'll look for Zeke there, and I'm sure we'll get lots of questions and some comments from Zeke, which will be great. Now, we also got an email from Mike Smith. He recently flew to California, and he sent us a link to the Delta safety video. Now, this is, and we'll have that in the show notes. You'll be able to look at this right there. It's the Delta Airlines safety card safety video, and I think it's really clever. What they've done is they've taken a safety card. Now, you can imagine most safety cards, which have sort of cartoonish depictions, people putting on their masks, doing their seatbelts, you know, all of that kind of stuff. They're usually illustrations of those activities. And in this video, what happens is those people in the safety card become animated, and they do interesting things as well as tell you about, you know, what the point of that particular topic is in the safety card. But there's all kinds of things going on in these animations. And I don't know, when I watched this thing, it just really held my attention. That's kind of the objective, right, of these the safety video or the safety talk from the cabin crew. And we've seen a lot of interesting ways airlines have found to try to amuse people or get their attention. This thing from Delta is pretty unique, pretty interesting.
It is funny how safety briefings have changed over the years. They used to be incredibly dry. Everybody ignored them. And yes, I think they have discovered that humor is one way to get people's attention. And this is kind of clever to see the way they animated what otherwise would be just cartoon drawings. So yeah, I like it too.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's very clever. It's almost like the safety briefing is sort of the entertainment for the flight, which is fine. Chris wrote to us also on episode 577 feedback. We talked about that Interceptor 400. And Chris says it reminds me a lot of the Evolution Turbine. And we'll have a link to that site. It's a four-seat pressurized turboprop. Also, he says, some assembly required. It does look kind of, it has the same kind of lines, I think, as that Interceptor 400 we talked about. Now, he also says, Chris also says that Austin Mayer has one of these. Okay, who's Austin Mayer? He's the guy that invented the X-Plane, the simulation software. Chris mentions that Mayer says that you take off at half power, which seems kind of crazy. But, you know, it's a little light carbon fiber airframe with a big PT-6 in the front of it.
Yeah, I have a client who has one. I haven't flown with him in it, but I think I probably will because I'm looking just to try out some different kinds of turbine aircraft. But yes, when Chris says, you know, some assembly required, no, it's like all assembly required. But of course, they did have a builder program where they would assist you in doing it. I think this was out of the Lance Air Company. My recollection is that they didn't sell more than about 60 or 70 of these aircraft as kits, and most of which I think probably did get completed. But the cost to a purchaser was around $1.1 million, something like that. And for that, you got an aircraft that was comparable to something that sold for over $2 million. You know, so it was a really remarkable bargain for someone who's willing to kind of go with a non-certificated product and some of the, you know, trade-offs involved with that, not the least of which is a fair amount of your time in the build process.
Yeah, I guess they have or had three models, three variants, but the EVOT 850, it's got a 867 shaft horsepower engine in the front. 11 minutes to 25,000 feet. That sounds pretty zippy.
Yep, that's pretty impressive. I didn't realize that Austin had one. I met Austin at PFC, which is Precision Flight Controls, which is a simulator manufacturer. We were both doing work for them up in Sacramento. At that time, he was flying a Columbia 400. I think he lived back east somewhere in the, I want to say South Carolina, North Carolina, somewhere around there. And so he would fly to his various consulting jobs around that. But it looks like he's stepped up to something a little faster, flies a little higher.
And not only that, but Chris mentions that regarding the Garmin Autoland, that he says, I wonder if they'd also teach it how to handle an engine failure similar to what, now how do you pronounce this? X-A-V-I-O-N?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Savion.com does, but doing the flying directly instead of just showing the path. The math would be pretty similar, he says, just leave out the thrust. Well, guess what? It's also software that Austin developed. And if you apparently, if you have an engine out, the software will pilot an easy-to-fly course to a nearby runway. From their webpage, they say that the software knows about your plane's glide characteristics, nearby terrain, guides you to the safest nearby runway, not just the closest. It says it provides an eye-powered backup for your primary flight instruments. If one goes out, simply you reference the software and continue on your way. So, wow, I mean, this Austin sounds like an interesting kind of guy.
Yeah, indeed. He's been very successful with the X-Plane. I was going to mention that there was another set of software that was similar to that. I was trying to go back and find the link. It was from a company called Vertical Power, and the name of it was something 400, as I recall. But it was the same type of emergency software, control the airplane, bring it back to landing in the case of an engine failure. I have heard secondhand from somebody who used to work for the company at the time that had been discontinued. Here it is. It's the VP-400, which was developed by mostly Lance Air, which, of course, is the company that developed the Evolution that we're just talking about now. It was apparently acquired from Vertical Power. One button push for emergency situations, and it would engage the autopilot to fly it and land at a speed that was 1.3 the stall speed. The purchase was purchased years ago and, quote, buried for liability reasons. Kind of an unfortunate end, you know, if that's true for a capable kind of product. So, yeah, I think that teaching Autoland new tricks is going to be high on list on the, you know, Garmin's plans. When I was out there with them last week, they said that they certainly plan to extend Autoland both upward and downward to other products, but I'm sure they'll do other things, give it new capabilities. Not that they talked about this kind of stuff, but I would have to imagine that engine out would be a pretty natural follow-on for this.
Boy, just so much automation coming in, not just in aviation, but at least in aviation, it's sort of critical to get it right. I mean, you like your self-driving car to be pretty accurate and solid and reliable, but you'd really like your airplane to be especially reliable in that regard.
And I think actually some of the airplane problems are probably simpler than some of the self-driving car problems. You're just fewer obstacles to deal with when you're up there.
Yeah.
I mean, granted,
no pedestrians.
Granted, you have one extra dimension, but boy, it's nothing compared to all the obstacles we've got down here. I was talking with someone recently who had left one of the self-driving car companies in Silicon Valley. And he said, you know, it's not going to come as quickly as everybody thinks it's going to come. He seems to think that this is a bigger problem than most people believe.
Yeah, no doubt. All right. Well, that'll do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. We want to thank you all for listening. Our guest was Lee Heumann, president and CEO of AeroTech. Lee, again, thanks so much for coming on the show. Are you doing much flying yourself these days? Do you have time for that anymore?
Yeah, I do. I do enjoy flying. We have a King Air that we run around for various reasons. So I fly that mainly. But Max-T will like the fact that we also have an SR-22 in our flying
club
and a couple 172s. So I get 75 hours a year. Not a tremendous amount, but enough to stay dangerous.
No, actually, I think that's enough to keep you fairly safe. You know, if I always tell folks if they're flying a 172, yeah, get at least 30 hours a year as you step up into a more complex aircraft. It helps to get more than that. But I think 75 is a pretty decent number of hours for most pilots.
Now, would you say a Vision Jet would kind of demand even more hours?
Good question. I'd have to wrap my mind around that.
All right.
I mean, I think 75 hours would probably work if that was the only plane that you were flying. I think that's the challenge, I think, as you get in more complex aircraft. Either you got to do more hours or you got to confine your flying to fewer airplane types.
Hmm. Okay, good point. All right. And again, Lee, thanks so much. And AeroTech can be found at their website, AeroTech.com. Of course, you can find us at AirplaneGeeks.com. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, that's airplanegeeks.com/578. If you'd like to send us an email, that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And I have to fall on my sword a little bit, and I'm kind of a little bit behind with the email. So some of you have, I know I can see it in there, haven't gotten to it yet, but will as soon as I can. And let's tell everybody where they can find us online. David Vanderhoof, how about you?
Well, you can join our Slack listener team by sending us an email to Max or me, and that's thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com, and we'll get you an invite. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, if you can spell Vanderhoof. And, of course, you can find me on Friday mornings talking about drones on the UAV Digest with that guy, Max Flight.
Great. And Max Trescott, where do we find you?
Well, they can find me on the flight line at Palo Alto in California. Anybody who's coming in the area and wants to fly in the San Francisco Bay Area, call me up. In fact, I just did a mountain flight with somebody. So if you want to do some mountain flying in a Cirrus, certainly up for doing that, depending upon the weather, of course. But online, it's the usual place. Go out to aviationnewstalk.com, click on contact at the top, or click on listener questions and record a listener comment for the show.
Great. And you can find me on Twitter at Max Flight. Look for me on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVDigest.com. And with Mary Kirby talking about the passenger experience on PaxXPodcast.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
Thanks for listening.